Good morning, everyone. We're going ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Thank you for being here. We have four bills that are on our agenda today for public hearing and possible work sessions. What we're going to do is work through the agenda, I believe, from the top to the bottom as listed. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 4026A. Charlotte?
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, House Bill 4026A comes to you from Rep. Thompson. It came across the floor with 52 aye votes and 4 no votes. And what it does, it relates to ignition interlock devices during a DUII diversion program. It requires the provider of an ignition interlock device to download reports that are stored on the device and to report any negative reports to the treatment provider, court, attorney of record, or person in the diversion program. Further, the measure allows courts to order that a person who has installed a device that it, should it not be capable of identifying the user to then install a device that can identify the user through the use of a camera or other technology, and it requires the Department of Transportation to develop rules about specific devices that can be used in Oregon programs.
Could you clarify the part about the identification? Is that going to be something that's going to be automatically required?
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, the bill would require going forward that the Department of Transportation publish a list of devices that use a camera. And those are the ones that are required to be used in Oregon.
If I could, Ms. Chair.
You may.
How much more expensive are those than the non-camera ones, or do we know?
Senator Cruz, we heard testimony on the House side that they were $10 to $15 more expensive per month than the current devices.
And do we have how much they cost right now, just the current devices?
Chair Prusansky, if I remember correctly, they are $60 to $75 per month. But I believe we have folks who can testify to that.
All right. Fine. Representative Thompson, why don't you please come forward?
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Thompson, House District 23, West Valley. This bill comes to you from the 35-member DOII work group that is authorized by the House Judiciary Committee and the House Healthcare Committee. We've been working for almost 2 years now going through DOII situations, trying to straighten out and streamline what we do here in Oregon and bring it up to newer national standards. And turns out it's a little more of a snake pit than what we thought at the beginning, and there's a good deal of work that still needs to be done. The issue at hand here is a fix that we discovered last session and didn't have time to do anything about it. When we issue the reports on interlock devices, well, if you fail an interlock device and a report is issued, according to statute, it doesn't go anywhere. It's just issued. So this straightens out that part, directs that the installer who generates the report will send it to the proper authorities. It goes to the defendant's attorney, if that person is of record, and starts the process. And the thinking behind this is this isn't just simple punishment. We're trying to help people get out from under an alcohol problem, and we need the people who are involved in that process to know what's going on. And this references to an ongoing debate we're having about the relationship between the legal structure punishment side of DOII and the much newer door that's opening, which is going to require us under the Affordable Care Act to treat people with substance abuse as a primary care problem. So we have to have the right information and the right direction to make all of this work. The other piece in here relates to the fact that we are aware that Oregon, in the words of one witness, is a dumping ground for DUII devices. We have not set up standards here at this time, and just about anything is available, many of which are not available or not allowed in other states. This doesn't correct that problem initially, but it does allow, if someone has one of these kinds of devices, that if in the opinion of court, when there is a violation, they can come back in and upgrade the present device with one that requires video recording. And this happens occasionally when there is reason to believe that or report that the person with the DUI device is having their son or daughter start the car for them, and then that has to be pursued at a higher level, or a number of other technicalities that come up. But it's just a way to increase the ante if that's necessary. The issue came up about cost, and I'm sympathetic to the problem, but I have had a number of people, last one, a young person in my district killed by a drunk driver. The parents of that kid weren't terribly interested in what the cost is to defer drunk driving. And I think if we did an analysis, we'd find that many of these people who have habitual alcohol problems are spending a lot more on alcohol than it would cost them to get a DUI device and get their life straightened out. So I don't think that's germane to the discussion. For people who are truly indigent, there are funds available to supplement their getting a device. So I think we're on the path of trying to develop a very good DUI, comprehensive DUI system here in Oregon that is both adheres to the letter of the law and also is compassionate toward trying to get people help. And that's the long-term solution, because we know people who don't get help don't quit drinking until they kill somebody or themselves. So it's a big problem. That's the thrust of the bill.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
All right, we have Dina Ryerson, Kristen Twing, and Sally Pina, I believe. Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Senator Pozanski, members of the committee. My name is Dina Ryerson. I work at the Department of Justice, and I'm here basically to answer any technical questions regarding the bill.
And Senator Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Kristen Twingy. I'm with Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and I'm here to say that Mothers Against Drunk Driving supports this bill.
I'm Sally Pena. I'm an ADIS over in Polk County. I've been an ADIS since 1981. I support the bill, but I'd like to take the time, if you have it, to explain exactly what the ADIS position does. The ADIS position was designed to be a bridge between treatment and the courts. When a client is arrested on a DUII, they're referred from the court to determine what type of program or if a treatment program is warranted. We meet with a client, do an evaluation, and refer them to a program. In addition to that, once they've been referred, we begin a monitoring process to make sure that they maintain compliance with that program. And if they don't, we advise the court of the fact that they're in noncompliance. The court brings them in and makes a determination in the case of a diversion, whether to maintain the diversion or to sanction them in the case of a conviction. Client is re-referred to us. We begin again with a transfer or with a re-referral to the agency and begin to monitor them again throughout the duration of their program. We also make referrals for out-of-state clients. We also maintain statistics for the State Alcohol and Drug Program Office. We are certified by OHA, who can revoke our certification at any time. We are designated by our courts, who can also revoke our designation at any time. We monitor on DUIIs, but we also have a second role, and that is we monitor and refer for marijuana diversion clients. But now, more recently, a third potential role for the ADIS has developed in terms of monitoring on the ignition interlock device reports. Right now, those reports are sometimes monitored because the court has been required by statute to appoint someone to receive those reports. And in some cases, it's the ADIS, and in some cases, no one's been designated. So there's not consistency throughout the state in terms of who's going to monitor the reports and also what is to be done with the reports once we receive them. For example, in Polk County, I do monitor for circuit court. Those reports go to the treatment agencies, who become aware of violations. But in other courts, municipal courts, those reports don't go anywhere. So there's inconsistency both in who receives them and what happens to them. With the ignition interlock device reports, we already have a system in place with the ADIS to take in information from the treatment agency and go to the court. That same process and that same client base can be utilized with the IID reports coming into the ADIS, going out to the treatment agency and to the courts. There's no reason to be setting up a new system. It is the most efficient both in terms of process and in terms of cost. The one thing that is not included in this bill that I wish was is a fee increase for the ADIS. Our fees have not been raised for DUIs in over 10 years. On the marijuana diversions, our fees, that again by statute, have not been raised in over a quarter of a century. We have been squeezed to the point where ADISs have a very difficult time functioning. And this additional obligation, which I believe is the most efficient way to do this, but unless it comes with a fee increase next session, I do not believe that the ADIS position will continue to be viable. So I ask you for your support of this bill, but I also ask you for your support next session of a fee increase that will make this possible for us to do.
Questions? Sally, I have a couple questions for you. What is the fee now for ADIS for DUII?
It's $150.
And so basically you've gone through as to what you do. How much time do you think is goes to per case, understanding that there's going to vary depending on...
It does vary a lot. In some cases, for example, on the diversions, we may monitor for 2 or 3 months. In some cases, we monitor for the entire year, then they go to court and get another extension. And in some cases, on the conviction clients, we're monitoring for a very long time, so it's very difficult. But the problem with the ADIS position is that we are not only taking our time, we're paying our overhead. We get no funding other than the fee that comes in from the client. We're paying our rent, we're paying our utilities, our equipment, our insurance, all of that is paid for by the ADIS. And most of the ADISs are small businesses. Some of them are connected in some way with corrections or a public entity. But by and large, the vast majority of us are independent. And so it would be kind of like if you were in private practice in any arena in life, that overhead is what eats you up. And the overhead continues to go up, and our fees continue to stay the same. When I started out, there were 5 or 6 ADISs in my county. I'm the only ADIS left standing. And quite frankly, if this bill next session doesn't pass with a fee increase and we have some support from somebody, I will close my doors, not because I want to, but because I have to.
All right. Let me ask you, since you've been in the business for a while, and my background as a prosecutor in the municipal court system, it seems to me that there's probably about 70%, I'm guessing at the number, but about 70% of individuals who go into diversion that we never see again. In other words, they are what I would call low-risk offenders for reoffending. Is that kind of comparable to what your experience is?
I haven't really kept stats on that, but yes, I agree with you that the vast majority of diversion clients do not reoffend. We don't see them again.
All right. So why would we want to put another onus on individuals that's going to cost them another $400 to $500 a year to do this? When and it seems like we're taking the approach one size fits all.
I understand that concern, but. In the big picture, the number of people in this country that are killed in DUIs is huge. Thousands of people every year lose their lives. And so it's a balance in terms of, do you want to not have the vast majority of the public subject to these because of the cost and inconvenience, or do you want to protect lives? I take the position that we protect lives. In those cases where people have an ignition interlock device on their car, they cannot drive. And it saves lots of people's lives.
All right, but we also in this state have taken a position on sentencing and looking at how we use our precious resources.
Yes.
As to basically grading people on their risk of reoffending, low, medium, and high risk offenders.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it seem that we'd want to have different levels of compliance requirements for those same individuals in this category? If they're low risk, maybe we don't need to put as much resources into that as compared to medium risk or high risk?
I think that in the general sense, that seems to make sense. But in a practical matter, I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you figure out which of these DUII offenders are going to reoffend. And they do. Obviously, we have conviction clients all the time. A good portion of our conviction clients who've had a prior DUII. So trying to ascertain at any credible level who's going to reoffend and who is not, I think is virtually impossible.
You say virtually impossible. It would seem to me that you could do a coalition based on maybe even their blow. I mean, our state has already taken a position in saying that if someone blows a .15 or greater, we're going to have higher, greater sanctions or restrictions on them as compared to someone that may be less than that.
That it, makes it difficult in terms of the fact that there are many times other substances involved besides alcohol. We have a lot of clients in our office on DUIs that are either marijuana or prescription medication where blood alcohol level is not going to be assisting you. But also, the blood alcohol level is very difficult to figure out the connection between level of need. Because, for example, if someone drinks themselves under the table and passes out and 6 hours later gets in the car and drives, you don't have a sense of the fact that they had a huge amount of alcohol in their system at one time, but it's dissipated and it's not reflected in the blood alcohol level.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought the Interlock device only measures alcohol, not other drugs.
Right, it does.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what would be helpful for me is some information on how many negative reports relative to how many devices are in use, and also what categories those negative reports come in, whether it's tampering or I mean, there's several categories, but Mr. Chair, I think that sort of information I might find helpful, if that's possible to get that.
Okay. Other questions, comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate, House Bill 4026A? Absolutely. Don't see anyone, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4026A. And we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 4081A. John?
Krasinski, members of the committee, House Bill 4081A comes to you from Representative Berger. In 2013, the legislature enacted House Bill 2060, which gave the Attorney General the authority to issue an order to disqualify charitable organizations who are not using a certain amount of their funds for their program services. 4081 goes a little bit further and offers oversight and enforcement tools for the Attorney General by allowing suspension, revocation, or denial of the registration of a charitable organization if that organization willfully fails to provide the required information or provides misleading or false statements on registration documents or annual reports. It passed the House floor with 57 aye votes.
All right, thank you. We have Representative Burgers here and Attorney General Ellen Rosenbaum. And
Elizabeth Grant.
Why don't y'all three come up? Thank you very much. Representative, did you want to start off?
I will. Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. Appreciate your indulgence in hearing this bill. I feel a lot in the judiciary setting. This is not my area of law or expertise. But I wanted to frame how I got here for you, and then I have the experts on what this does beside me. Last winter, I was watching the TV news, and a lot of the TV news is, as you know, the crime report and not worth the time I spent in front of it. But there was a really excellent report on a hole in our enforcement on these charity laws. It basically says you will do these things, but if you don't do them, no consequence, which leaves it where the Attorney General could say, well, you filed this report falsely, call them up and say, don't do that anymore, and if they do it again, so what? There was literally no way of getting people to enforce compliance and honesty in the filings that were being made. So it occurred to me that this is fixable, and that we had a short session coming, and that I wanted to step into this and try and see if we could get this fixed. This is the provenance of this particular bill. I contacted the Attorney General's office, and in working with them, we believe this fills this hole. We also, and there will be testimony, worked with the nonprofit organizations, because every one of us is well aware that there are thousands of nonprofits who are staffed by volunteers who make honest mistakes, and none of us want to go after them. But there are also big organizations that just lie. just this report just showed them just out and out lying when checking a box that says, do you have judgments against you? Big dollar judgments. They just say, no. No consequence for that lie. No way to say, wait a minute. You know, you have to be honest if you're going to be a charity in this state. So that is the bill before you. I appreciate your hearing it. It was well received in the House, and I will ask the Attorney General and her staff to answer your technical questions.
Good morning. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Attorney General for the state of Oregon. And we come before you today in support of House Bill 4081. With me is Elizabeth Grant. She's the head of our Department of Justice Charitable Activities section. And I would like to thank Representative Vicki Berger for her leadership in bringing attention to this issue and helping us to develop the legislative concept that became House Bill 4081 and that has gone through the House of Representatives process, as she indicated. I would also like to thank Jim White, who's not able to be here in person today, but who has submitted some written testimony. He is the executive director of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon. I want to thank him for his support and constructive suggestions as well throughout the drafting process. And his organization is very supportive of this bill, which has incorporated nearly all of those suggestions into the amended version, which was presented to the House and is before you today. I've said it before, but I feel strongly that it bears repeating. The vast majority of charities in Oregon are doing an amazing job, delivering the maximum possible return for every dollar that's donated. But for various reasons, there are a small minority of charitable organizations that struggle to maintain the sort of financial and organizational transparency that Oregonians deserve in return for their charity. This bill seeks an appropriate balance between providing assurance that charitable organizations are being truthful, accurate, and transparent in their interactions with state regulators while not overburdening the vast majority of already compliant charities with unnecessary paperwork, busy work, or red tape. As I'm sure you know, we have thousands of charitable organizations that are registered with our charitable activities section. In fact, upwards of 18,000 at the present time. And since 1996, this number has almost doubled. So as you can imagine, as the number of charities has increases, so have the number of cases where the information provided in the required reports is incomplete, misleading, or simply incorrect. For example, our annual report form contains a question which inquires of a charity if they've ever been the subject of a disciplinary action in any other state in the past. And that's what Representative Berger was referring to. The recent audit by KATU found at least 30 charities which had indicated within their report with our office that they had never been subject to a disciplinary action in another state. And this was just simply not true. And the scope of these out-of-state violations varied, ranging from fairly minor small administrative fees for missed filings up to judgments in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for allegations of misleading donors, or in some cases they had been suspended, their registration had been suspended in the other states. So the Department of Justice relies on these reports to look for everything from accidental but important mistakes in reporting all the way up to deliberate patterns of misrepresentation or management. And that's how this bill can help us. It clarifies several aspects of the reporting requirement and provides our charities division with additional tools to investigate possible noncompliance. New language in Section 7 of the bill clearly specifies violations of Oregon's Charitable Trust and Corporation Act, and it makes clear that the Attorney General has the ability to request documents to substantiate representations made in a registration document or another report. It allows the Attorney General to request information to establish that a charitable organization has properly applied charitable funds received by donors. And it also explicitly prohibits the filing of a false or misleading statement. So while we might have been able to go after them now for these types of violations, this provides the specificity that makes it clear what those violations are. Section 7 also provides us with a series of enforcement mechanisms to address compliance issues. As the head of my charitable activities section, Ms. Grant can tell you that many of our enforcement actions are as simple as sending a letter or correcting a misunderstanding. And we do not resort to more formal actions unless more cooperative attempts at obtaining the necessary information or bringing in an organization into compliance have failed. But when we feel that a bigger stick is needed, Section 7 ensures that the charitable organization receives a fair process in the course of obtaining this information and proceeding with the enforcement action. So, in conclusion, it bears repeating that most charities follow the law, and some of those that break the rules do so because of a simple misunderstanding or a mistake, and we can work with those organizations, and we do. But it's important that we have the ability to obtain the accurate information we need, and that is required. So that concludes my testimony, and Ms. Grant is available to answer any technical questions that you may have.
Questions?
Thank you.
Senator Cruz first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. We've been dealing with, I've been dealing with a lot of issues relative to our federally recognized tribes in the state, and we have government-to-government relationships. Do you have oversight over tribal trusts as well?
This is Elizabeth Grant. I'm with the Department of Justice. Not directly. We don't have oversight over tribal organizations or charitable trusts, although sometimes we do work with tribes. Sometimes the tribal foundations will give money to local groups or groups here in Oregon, and occasionally we've found problems with that or they've reported concerns. And so in that case, we have conducted investigations and have sometimes been involved in assisting the tribes either recover charitable funds or find out what happened to them.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Chair. Because I know that the majority of their philanthropy does go outside of tribes, so... Okay, so thank you for that.
Senator Close.
Thank you. Ms. Grant, the panelists testified about a recent audit by KATU about organizations that have been charged in another state. Can you give us a number on how many that has been in the past year?
I think the KATU, this is Elizabeth Grant with Department of Justice and Chair Brzezinski, Senator Close. I think KATU identified approximately 30 organizations. And there's something before that, it was hard to know whether organizations had not reported that information to us. Part of the reason why KATU was recently able to identify that discrepancy is because another newspaper, another group, Tampa Bay, has made an effort recently to compile enforcement actions against other states. So that's now provided some mechanism to investigate further and find this out. Otherwise, it is fairly difficult. And before that database was developed, it was somewhat difficult to know whether there had been other enforcement actions or not.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So out of the 30 that were ID'd by KATU, how many did you prosecute or suspend?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Close, we have not yet taken action, in part because the legislation is not very clear, and the KATU report highlighted that we'd be in a better position in the future with the legislative changes before you. The report only came out in, in October, November, and some of the organizations that were identified in that we were familiar with and have addressed in other ways. Some other organizations called and said that they would be adjusting their reports in light of that. So we haven't really acted upon that yet, because we're sort of waiting to see the results of this legislation to help strengthen our ability to go after those organizations, and waiting for organizations to address it on their own.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Excuse me. I realize that I have failed to send each member of this committee a link to that original report. I will have my staff do that. And that was an oversight on my part. I meant to do that, and it just got past me. But I will be sure that you get a link to the original report.
Representative Berger, if you can just send it to our staff, that way it can be within the whole system.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can I have one more question?
You may.
If I may. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Berger, I'm just noticing the civil penalty doubling from $1,000 to $2,000. What was your decision-making process for doubling the fine?
In my own mind, it was a... I went back and asked, how long has that been in there? And nobody really knew. We run across this all the time. We put a fine on there and then never think, well, is it enough? Is it adequate? Is it not? I was willing to make it larger in light of the fact that in the KATU report, you will see that these charities have huge judgments against them. And clearly, there is... other states are doing much bigger fines than we are. Some of them had like $20,000 worth of judgments, and then they said, no, we have no problems in other states. So I thought that it was a tool in the toolbox to get their attention. I did not want to raise it to a particularly high level, and I was guided by the Attorney General's office in this, in raising that fine, for no other reason than to make sure that the bite stings.
Thank you.
All right, let me just make some clarification there. It's not a mandatory fine. It's up to that amount. And I also was looking at that, and I understand where it went up in the first part of the bill, but Section 7, I actually think we need to be monitoring this. I think we may want to have different levels based on infractions as to the degree of what it is and how frequent they may become a problem. Because $2,000, even though that's a lot, it could be just the cost of doing business. Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you.
You bet. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 4081A? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 4081A. And we're going to go open up our next public... let's go ahead and open up a work session on 4081A. I think we got all the paperwork we need. And so, colleagues, if we're comfortable with this one, we can go ahead and get this one on its way. And Senator Close, if you're so inclined.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I was getting the bill out. Would you repeat?
I wonder if you'd give us a motion on House Bill 4081A to move it to the floor of the due pass recommendation, if you're ready for that. Or,
you know, I think there's some questions here that we need to have answered. I know Mr. Knott has been given a sheet of some concerns. I'm not prepared to move this to the floor at this point.
Okay. Are you comfortable with that? Senator Rowland?
Chair. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4081A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Rowland moves House Bill 4081A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, doubling a fine and not defining willful in this bill concerns me. You talked about the cost of doing business. For a huge organization, $2,000 may not be a lot. For a little animal shelter that misses a report and did not do it on purpose, we're told they may work with them, but there's no assurance that they might not be fined the same $2,000. So I think that we need to work more on this bill. So I will be a no.
Okay. So, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. I'm looking at the track record of the Department of Justice, and for the most part, they work hand in hand, especially with the small charities. And it's not an out to get you thing. It's just a matter of getting the information, and they give them time, and they actually help them fill out the reports if that's necessary. This bill is targeted at the big guys who are, in my mind, bloodsuckers, and to a large degree, I think when I look at the record of our Department of Justice and how they do these, I don't think it's going to be a gotcha thing, but I think to have something in place that is a greater definition of what needs to be done and some tools to get after these multi-state quote-unquote charities that don't do things right. I think this is appropriate. I agree with you, Mr. Chair, that's something worth monitoring over time to see if more definition needs to be done. But at this point in time, I'm comfortable with the direction we're going.
All right, I'll just put on the record.
I just want to go along the same line, because I agree with what Senator Cruz just said, and I also agree with other departments. Having been on some nonprofits and done Treasury stuff, the Treasurer portion of that, and having worked with the Department of Revenue, who step-by-step walks you through things. I mean, if you are a small nonprofit, Oregon's agencies really work hard to help you do the right things. And I appreciated all the help that I got in those early days with some of those nonprofits that I worked with. And so I tend to believe that this is really to protect a lot of those people, because these others come in and often take away resources that would have gone to local charities that are really doing the right thing and then misuse that funds. And I really appreciate it. I think you need the Department of Justice needs the tools to go after the ones that are causing the problem for the ones that are doing it right.
Okay. And I just want to put on the record, again, the fine amount going up to $2,000 is a maximum. It is not a mandatory minimum type of fine. It's one that just gives more flexibility. I would assume, based on the track record that the department has had previously in other areas and arenas, that they will be, if not setting a schedule, they will in fact have some type of consistency based on what the violation is or what the difficulty. And the word willful is defined in statute, and so I expect that they will be working within the confines of the Oregon revised statutes as to how willful has been interpreted before. Any other comments or discussions?
One last comment. I'd just like to reply to the agencies, state agencies working with the public on fines. We all know with the Secretary of State's office, you miss a report or have an accounting error, you are fined.
All right. Any other questions? Any other comments? Objections to the motion that's before us? Senator Close is on record. No. Anyone else? Motion passes. And Senator Cruz, did you want to, or Roblin?
He's been in those shoes. Okay. I think he'd be the appropriate one.
Senator Roblin will be the carrier of House Bill 4081A. And we'll close the work session on 4081A, open up a public hearing on House Bill 4094A. And Chana?
Chair Posansky, members of the committee, House Bill 4094A comes to you from Representative Doherty. It passed the House floor with 57 aye votes. It deals with our minor in possession statute. If a minor has alcohol in their possession and they seek medical or law enforcement assistance for themselves or another due to the alcohol consumption, and the only evidence of the violation is gathered from the act of seeking assistance, then they are given immunity to prosecution.
Before, Representative, you give your testimony, I see Katie King is also scheduled. Why don't you go ahead and come on up? And just for my information, is there anyone else who wants to testify today on 4094A?
Mr. Chair, I was going to support this, and now Katie's
going to. All right.
Oh, well.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and come to the table? Representative, why don't you get us started?
Okay, thank you very much, Chair Brosnansky and members of the committee. The worst nightmare that any parent can have, I am Representative Margaret Doherty, House District 35, Tigard in Southwest Portland. But the worst nightmare a parent can have is that phone call or the knock at the door at 3 o'clock in the morning, and on the other side is law enforcement with the information that your child has died. This happened to one of my constituents, where her best friend, her son's best friend at Arizona State, died of alcohol poisoning, and he was there and did not do anything about it, and it's been haunting him ever since. I come before you today with a very good bill designed to save lives. House Bill 4094 extends a limited legal immunity to those minors who summon medical aid for another minor who is suffering alcohol poisoning or an alcohol emergency. Underage drinking is unfortunately quite common in Oregon, and many drink to unconsciousness. Just this fall, we had a case of five students at University of Oregon that ended up in the hospital in one day. But far more frightening than those minors who end up in the hospital are those who don't. Alcohol poisoning and alcohol consumption is an incredibly serious situation that requires immediate medical attention. And the case of a young person abandoned on a couch or a front step with no aid is hauntingly familiar. As studies have shown, this situation is the result of the fear of calling law enforcement for help because of the possibility of involving law enforcement and sometimes university administration. When that fear is removed, calls from minors who need medical assistance go up dramatically. A study at Cornell University, which I believe you have in your materials, found that by implementing a program like this, it increased the calls to emergency for services by 45%. And this happened as levels of underage drinking either stayed the same or fell, according to the statistics of from Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, which is a branch of the Health and Human Services Department, and that tracks the statistics on underage drinking. The fact is that these young people are making a lot of bad decisions. They're choosing to drink underage, and they're choosing to drink at a very unhealthy level. These choices are awful, but that shouldn't merit a death sentence, which is what the fear of an MIP can sometimes do. The bill in front of you will save lives by encouraging young people to call emergency services, and we can make sure that nobody's bad decision is actually a termination of someone's life. The bill is very narrowly written. It applies only to the MIP charge, which in Oregon is a Class B violation, which is on the same level as a speeding ticket, but kids don't know that. It does not apply in any way to other serious charges that might be associated with the drinking, such as a DUI, providing alcohol to minors, if there's drugs in the room, that kind of thing. The bill contains a provision that specifies that if evidence of another crime, such as drug use or driving under the influence, is discovered, it is unaffected by this bill. It further specifies that immunity only applies to the evidence of underage drinking is found as a result of seeking medical assistance. And so that was something that was very important. So in other words, to be covered by this bill, the minor would need to actively seek medical assistance. It is a kind of a common sense idea that's been passed in 17 different states along with the District of Columbia. There are another 10 states that are talking about it right now. And the states are as diverse as Utah and California. So I encourage the passage of House Bill 4094. It passed on the House 57-0, and there's no organized opposition. Law enforcement and the district attorneys are neutral. We did meet with the district attorneys after the initial hearing in the House Judiciary and came up with some compromises, and so they are neutral on the bill. Thank you very much, and I urge passage to the floor.
All right, thank you. Katie?
Thank you. Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Katie King, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, and OSEP supports the bill. Emergency medicine physicians are frequently called upon to provide care for people of all ages who experience alcohol overdose. And alcohol poisoning is a medical emergency that results from high blood alcohol levels that suppress the central nervous system and can cause loss of consciousness, low blood pressure and body temperature, coma, respiratory depression, or death. The Centers for Disease Control estimate that there were over 1.2 million emergency room visits and 2.7 million physician office visits due to excessive alcohol use in 2006. You've heard about tragedies that result from teenage binge drinking, but let me share with you a story of a young person that did the right thing. Recently, a student brought their friend in to an emergency department in Eugene, Oregon. The young patient had an extremely high blood alcohol level, and immediate measures needed to be taken to support the patient's breathing. However, the student's decision to bring the friend in may have saved his life. The emergency department physician made a point of thanking the student that brought his friend in for his courage to come forward and to let him know that he had done the right thing rather than wait until it was too late. A few other examples. A 15-year-old female was dropped off at an Oregon emergency department very late at night, not breathing, unresponsive, and smelling of alcohol. Her friends gave her name and left. The emergency department physician had to intubate her and put her on a respirator to breathe until the very next morning. Fortunately, she had no obvious residual damage, and she was discharged home with her family. So the kids did the right thing by bringing her in, but it easily could have been too late. And finally, an 18-year-old male college freshman was found by another student at a school event on the restroom floor, unresponsive but breathing on his own, but possibly had aspirated vomit. He was naive about alcohol, but urged to drink more and more by an upperclassman. Sometime before the patient was transferred to the hospital by ambulance, the police served him with an MIP ticket. He did not realize that since he was unconscious when it was served. He recovered overnight on oxygen and observation in the emergency department of the local hospital. The doctor heard later from the family that the patient had found an MIP ticket in the pair of his jeans a few weeks later. He didn't know anything concerning it because he was unconscious, and in fact, he didn't even know what an MIP ticket was. All of these patients were very fortunate not to have died of respiratory arrest from acute alcohol poisoning. In these instances, the window between life and death is short, and it's critical to get the patient to immediate help. This bill will help promote more scenarios like that. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Sir, your name?
Chair Pozanski, Vice Chair Close, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Thomas Letchworth.
Could you spell your last name, please?
L-E-T-C-H-W-O-R-T-H. It's an old
Thank
English
you.
Name. I'm the student body president at Southern Oregon University, and I serve on the board of directors for the Oregon Student Association. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 4094A, the medical amnesty bill. I cannot stress enough just how important it is that we change the system so as to avoid punishing individuals when they try to do the right thing by calling emergency personnel in an emergency situation. Empowering people to seek medical assistance for individuals in distress without the fear of legal retribution because they themselves may be intoxicated is something that should have been done a long time ago. It needs to get done because it will absolutely save lives. My freshman year of college, my roommate, one of his friends, and I all went to a Halloween party. And I'm sure this body is aware that drinking excessively on Halloween is a favorite pastime of young adults in this country. On this particular Halloween, one of the young adults who chose to excessively drink just happened to be my roommate's friend. And for the sake of this testimony, I'll refer to him as John, because I know he'd rather I not publicly mention his name. We had not had a chance to eat dinner because we were too busy trying to get our costumes together at the last minute, and as such, we all had empty stomachs when we arrived at the party. Within the span of about an hour and a half, John had consumed the better part of a fifth of vodka. Soon after, he was in such a state that he could no longer stand up, speak, or even remain coherent for more than a few seconds. However, he was not throwing up. We began to worry that he might have alcohol poisoning, but weren't sure exactly what to do. We were underage at the time and were concerned about getting MIPs on our records. We weren't sure if we could be held liable or punished by the law in some other way after calling the authorities, and we didn't want him to wake up the next day with a large bill from an ambulance in addition to a furnishing charge from the police. As such, even though we were pretty sure that he was in the process of getting alcohol poisoning, we refrained from calling an ambulance. Instead, I called my girlfriend at the time, who was training to become an EMT. Now, she told me, she let me know that so long as he threw up soon, he should have been fine, and that if he wasn't throwing up, then we should burn some toast and force him to eat it because it functions like a natural Ipecac. Luckily, right then, he began to throw up. And eventually, we were able to get John home safely, and he ended up being all right. However, he was very close to suffering from alcohol poisoning that night, and he could have died if he didn't throw up. Now, never again should anyone in this state have to make the choice that we had to make that night, the choice between gambling with one's career, one's schooling, and future, or gambling with someone's life. People should not be afraid to do the right thing. They should not be punished for being good Samaritans. If someone has to call an ambulance for their friend or acquaintance because of some kind of substance overdose, they shouldn't be punished for it. Seeing a friend get carted away in an ambulance is punishment enough. And my personal opinion is that this is a good start, but it needs to be expanded to encompass more substances than just alcohol. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Excuse me, I would like to add one thing. One thing that we did with the district attorneys is to make sure that we encourage the universities to continue their drug and alcohol education. The universities actually do a pretty good job, and I was impressed once we started looking at this, at some of the things that they do. For example, Oregon State is...
Representative?
Yes.
Would you like the bill to move forward today, or do you want to wait for another day?
Would you like me to finish and conclude, sir? It's a good bill.
I have another bill. I've got 6 minutes to get three more members up here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4094A and open up a work session on House Bill 4094A.
Senator Close? Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4094A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Close moves House Bill 4094A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Just a quick comment. This was addressed really with college students. I really want to make sure that we understand this also applies to high school students. And having been a high school principal and taking kids to the hospital to get their stomachs pumped and get to have the other kinds of things, as well as knowing that those things happen in high schools, and a lot of those kids, it's the first time they ever drink where they over, people give them much too much, and they need to have the surety that they can get that person taken care of. So, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Cruz. Yeah,
just briefly to Representative Gordy, just tell Jack I helped you on this, okay?
All right. Thank you very much. Any other discussion? Any objection to the motion that's before us? Not seeing any. Motion passes. And do we have anyone who would like to be the carrier? Senator Cruz will be the carrier on House Bill 4094A. And with that, we close the work session. We'll open up our last public hearing on House Bill 4114A. Donna?
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, House Bill 4114A deals with the program that is out of Multnomah County District Court, which is a volunteer protected person special advocate program. It allows the probate court to appoint a volunteer to oversee professional and lay fiduciaries such as guardians and conservators. It passed the House floor with 57 aye votes. There are some amendments in the works, I hear, but I have not seen them yet.
All right. My goal is to try to get the testimony in today. It sounds like we have a little bit more work to be done, so we'll carry the bill over for work session. But if we can get the testimony in, that would help us and keep y'all from coming back. Senator?
I'll defer to the representative first.
Right. Thank you. Chair Prasansky and committee members, my name is Joe Gallegos. I'm the representative from House District 30. And I'm bringing to you before today 4140, which is the Protected Persons Special Advocacy Bill, which comes to you unanimously from the House. This bill simply gives presiding judges the authority to appoint trained special advocates to monitor court guardianships to ensure we are protecting some of our most vulnerable Oregonians. You know, one of the things is as we have this baby boom generation just on the edge of retiring and aging out, where we can anticipate an increasing number of frail elderly and individuals with cognitive disabilities and so on. So this bill is really timely in that it will help us to then be prepared for and really cover a lot of the issues right now with regard to disabilities, cognitive disabilities, and impaired decision making. In our court system, we can designate these individuals as protected persons. The judges have the ability to appoint these individuals a guardian who assumes the responsibility of managing the legal and financial decisions for this protected person. The problem arises in that the court has very little oversight of these guardianships. This lack of oversight is a problem that this bill is intended to fix. In terms of some data, in 2011, there were 36 guardian conservators of protected people who were reported perpetrators of their protected persons. So this bill will actually then give judges a chance to monitor that kind of process and make sure that we are have safeguards in place for not just the seniors, but also disabled individuals who may be cognitively impaired. This is a very simple bill, but it's a very powerful bill. We have the opportunity in this state to better protect our most vulnerable. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thanks for having us bring this bill, House Bill 4114, to you. I'm State Senator Lori Moniz Anderson from Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and East Portland. And it's really important for us to start taking a hold of the tsunami of elderly that are coming into our system. And we want to make sure that they are not subject to abuse and neglect, and whether their guardianship is appropriate, or whether their guardian is, or whether the elderly are actually receiving the appropriate services. And as a public health nurse, I've been in homes that really are appalling to most people. One blind woman with, I don't know, 24 or more cats. I went into her home, and my job was just to trim her toenails and her fingernails. Her nails, she was blind, she was confined, had actually grown and were curling around. They were at least 6 inches to a foot long in some cases. And there was a woman coming in every day to check her out, etc. But the filth was unbelievable, and the fact that her hygiene, she just wasn't able to care for herself. We started the process, but that's one issue where the guardian, if it was taken to court, an advocate could help solve some of that problem. And last year in McMinnville, a father had disowned his children. And the female that came in to care for him took advantage of him and basically depleted his financial, all of his money, practically, including some of his property. So I think this is just one step that we can take to help our aging seniors. Thank you.
Questions for Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Chair. I fully support what you're after. I, as sponsors of the bill, I would request that you take a look at the -A4 amendments, which is meant to make sure that financial institutions aren't inadvertently wrapped in this thing.
Right, so. And we've talked to the person. I am fine with that amendment. I have no problem with that amendment.
The chair's already been informed that this was one that needed to be in, just for clarification. We know that banks and others that are formerly under a fiduciary duty already have regulations and standards that they have to apply under, which is what the A-Force will do. Thank you all very much. I have two other people that are scheduled to give testimony. I'm going to see if we can't get them in. I believe it's Mary Yeager and Fred Steele. No, we got...
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Fred Steele. I am what is referred to as the state legal services developer under the Federal Older Americans Act. My position is housed at the Department of Human Services, but I'm not here to speak for the Department of Human Services. The department is neutral on the bill, and it sounds like we're short on time. Do I need to be as quick as possible? So two points that I wanted to provide. One is in my written testimony about a stakeholder collaborative that has come together here in the past year of 30-plus entities, individuals, including family guardians, all with an interest on guardianship and improvements in our guardianship infrastructure, so guardianship, conservatorship, and related alternatives to those forms. And looking at, we've identified about 25 issues that really need to be addressed in the short term, long term. Speaking to this bill and House Bill 4114, the volunteer guardianship monitoring, our WINGS group, our Working Interdisciplinary Network of Guardian Stakeholders group, it's a mouthful, it's not built to take positions on bills, but we have prioritized this issue, and it is something that we want to be working on in the short term and look forward to providing assistance, and we don't know exactly what that assistance will look like going forward, but looking forward to providing assistance in implementing these type of volunteer guardian monitoring programs statewide. And with this bill and this legislation, that will be extraordinarily helpful to do so. And I have provided my written testimony, a membership list, and you'll see Senator Dembro's name on there too, has been extremely supportive and participatory and wonderful on that group as we move forward. The other capacity that I wanted to speak from is as a DHS, a Department of Human Services representative on the legislatively created Elder Abuse Work Group. And Senator Montes Anderson spoke to this to some degree about not only the safety and protections that can be provided by getting a volunteer guardian to go in and make sure that the guardian is not abusing the protected person and the elder, whether it's an elderly person or a vulnerable adult. But the thing I'd like to stress is that it's also as much about the independence, that if you have a volunteer going in to make sure that the guardianship is also working as well as it should be under the court's orders and the probate judge's orders in a guardianship, that guardianship should be amplifying as much independence as possible for that protected person. And so that balance of independence and safety, even from an elder abuse perspective, in preventing elder abuse is extraordinarily important. So I'd be happy to take any questions.
All right. Mary?
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. I'm Mary Yeager, the long-term care ombudsman, and I'm appearing before you today both in that capacity and as the former director of the CASA program, the court-appointed special advocates for Multnomah and Washington counties. Both of these programs, and I've now been involved 15 years, rely on the goodwill of citizen volunteers. And I just wanted to make sure that you know that I, as an individual, I, as a state ombudsman, and on behalf of all the volunteers I've worked with, really believe in the citizen model. There are those who would say, let's wait, we can get FTEs, we can get government to come up with more money. In the 10 years that I worked with the CASA program in Multnomah and Washington counties, we helped over 4,000 children with trained, very professional, independent volunteers. Judge Tennyson from Multnomah County, who's actually the brainchild behind this bill, looked not only at the CASA statute, but at the ABA recommendations for community monitoring of guardianship activities. So I just wanted to come in both in support of the bill and urge that we deal with all the amendments so that this wonderful program can help other Oregonians across the state. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions, comments?
Mr. Cruz? Just a comment, because we've given Mary more work now, thanks to Senator Dembrough. And so this issue is being dealt with the Silver Tsunami and other committees, and I think we're making progress. This is part of that.
Senator Dembrough.
Mr. Chair, I can't say enough in support of this bill, but I'll reserve my time for when we're in work session.
All right. So basically, let me just check. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony that didn't sign up for 4114A? Not seeing any, we're going to close the public hearing. And colleagues, what the plan is to bring back 4114A as well as 4026A on Thursday. We are under 1 hour notice, so we could bring it back sooner tomorrow if things work out, but I think we're going to need a little bit of time for this all to get the paperwork and everything. So we'll plan on carrying those over and having those posted for this coming Thursday. Realize, if I remember correctly, next Tuesday is our final day to move bills out of a committee that are from the House. We have another, this is the first four. I understand there may be up to another 12 bills that are coming out of the House Judiciary that are being voted on that we may be seeing. So we may have a little extra need for moving forward as to earlier times. At this point for tomorrow, do we know what we have on the schedule?
I do not know.
So we have 1 hour notice. Realize that our scheduled time is 8 o'clock. We'll determine whether we need to meet at 8 or if we can meet a little bit, start a little bit later. All right, with that, we're adjourned for the day. Thank you.